Welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Rizza. I'm an allied healthcare professional that has worked in the industry for over 25 years, with the majority of my practice being in the private physical therapy space and in public school athletics. My curiosity prompted me to create Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast to discuss the ever-changing landscape in the healthcare industry, focusing on sports medicine, physical therapy, athletic training, and sports science. Each week, we will discuss the barriers that healthcare professionals face and how we as individuals can collaborate to make the listener better understand the industry for a better patient and athlete experience. Now, on to the show. On this week's Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast, we welcome Dr. Thomas Gill. Dr. Gill is professor of orthopedic surgery at Tufts University School of Medicine, chairman of orthopedic surgery for the Steward Healthcare System, co-director of the New England Baptist Sports Medicine Fellowship Program, and director of the Boston Sports Medicine and Research Institute. Dr. Gill has a strong commitment to education and serves as course director or faculty member for many continuing medical education courses. After graduating Phi Beta Kappa and magna cum laude in biology from Harvard College, Dr. Gill received his medical degree from Harvard Medical School. He performed his internship in general surgery at the Massachusetts General Hospital and completed his orthopedic surgery training at the Harvard Combined Orthopedic Residency Program. Upon his graduation, Dr. Gill was awarded the Maurice E. Mueller Scholarship to study adult reconstructive surgery in Bern, Switzerland, and throughout other European academic centers. He then completed his fellowship training in sports medicine and shoulder surgery at the Stedman Hawkins Clinic in Vail, Colorado. Dr. Gill has served as medical director for the Boston Red Sox, head team physician for the New England Patriots, team physician for the Boston Bruins, and medical director of the Boston Ballet. He is a fellow of the American Association of Orthopedic Surgeons, a member of the American Orthopedic Society for Sports Medicine, has been a member of the team physician societies of Major League Baseball, the National Football League, and the National Hockey League, and was elected to the Herodica Society and the American Orthopedic Association. Dr. Gill's primary clinical and research interests include knee and shoulder injuries, and he has a particular interest in biomechanics of the knee and shoulder, as well as tissue engineering techniques for the joint preservation and cartilage repair in the knee. Dr. Gill has authored over 200 original articles and chapters on basic science and clinical issues involving the knee and the shoulder, and has previously written books on complications of shoulder surgery and techniques of knee arthroscopy. Welcome to Episode 5, Part 2, where Dr. Gill and I focus on the importance of mental aspects in sports medicine and the role of mentorship in shaping a successful career. We also go on to discuss and emphasize the importance of clear expectations and communication with young athletes to shape them as individuals and help them manage their injuries. We close out the episode by discussing the evolution of concussion management in sports and the role of neurocognitive testing. Dr. Gill shares his experience working with professional athletes in the different modalities in football, hockey, and baseball. Now on to part two.
Yeah, we talk all the time about the mental aspect of it. That's the one thing I start with right away, even with parents, is that I need to figure out how to fix the top third of your child, right? So we got to fix what's above their shoulders and get their head back in the game. So I think they appreciate that we're looking at everything, the total athlete, and not just the injury and focusing on the injury, which has been kind of the thing that I like to focus in, you know, with them, is just the total body, the total person, and making sure they want to go back to it. Because sometimes kids just like, you know what, I'm done. I don't really want to go. And that's fine. You know, let's get you ready for life, you know, if we need to. Especially, you know, we talk about like the expectations up front. We get a cuff repair from you that comes in and it's, hey, listen, for 3 months, we're just working on mobility. We're trying to get your motion back. We're going to work on accessory muscles. When you see the doctor at week 12, they say you're good to go. We'll start doing your cuff strengthening. So as long as they know that up front, there's a clear expectation and they're not doing something stupid at home, which some people still do. But, you know, as long as we're being, you know, forthcoming with them, then they understand the expectation. I think that's where the heart of sports medicine really is with the young athlete. And I feel like you have a lot more ability to shape that person as a young athlete and for them to understand what's expected of them and how to be able to bring them into, you know, carry this for the rest of their life as into an adulthood, how to understand how to manage this stuff, which is good for them.
I think that, you know, one of the things that was great for me working with the professional teams for so long and working with some great athletic trainers, like people like Jim Whalen and Joe Van Allen, yourself, over the years is that we took a lot of what we quote unquote learned from the NFL, from the NHL, from Major League Baseball. You know, these are athletes who can get, you know, you want to get three MRIs on someone at various points along their recovery. Sure. You know, the team's writing a check, you know, cost was no issue. So we could experiment with different types of strengthening, different types of rehab protocols, things like the AlterG, you know, which I think revolutionized getting people back to running by altering how much weight they're doing when they're running on a treadmill. And that, you know, all the concussion we did have now came straight out of the NHL and the NFL, right? It's mm-hmm. all the athletic trainers that were documenting all the data from early on. We could have all the neuropsych testing and all that stuff we learned from the pros. We were then able to take and now bring it down to the real grassroots level, the young athlete. And if you look at some of the benefits of, you know, that's why I felt so lucky taking care of both professional athletes, high school athletes. You know, I learned things from the high school kids that I was able to, you know, translate to the pros. But there's a ton that I learned from the professional care that absolutely, I think, has standardized and actually really accelerated how we deal with young athletes, both on the preventative side, but also on the therapeutic and performance side as well.
Yeah, I mean, we started back. I remember you and I had this conversation because I asked you, how is the NFL, when you were working with the Patriots and the Red Sox and the Bruins, I said, how is the NFL managing head injury? This was back in like 2005 or six, because we were going to bring in neurocognitive testing for the first time. And we were the only public school in Massachusetts was actually going to do this. And we had brought in impact testing. And again, it was a learning process, a learning curve. But we kind of revolutionized that in our high school, which was great. We started with the football, the contact sports, and then we started moving into all the sports. And then finally, everybody was getting it through all the sports teams once a year. And I remember you saying to me, like, we don't even have it in the NFL yet. And I think it started to come in after that because it was such a big blow up with the concussion management of concussion in the NFL in the Players Association. So we had since moved on from impact, and now we use Sway Medical, which incorporates a lot of balance testing, and you can do it on your phone. It's more easily accessible. But we use that as a component for us, and it's really a tool in the toolbox for us to be able to manage the care the way we need to manage the care for the athlete. Now, I might have an athlete come in and I do a vestibular ocular motor screen on them acutely to see if they potentially have a concussion. We take a symptom registry from them, and then we would then do a neurocognitive test a day or two later if they're symptomatic and their symptoms start to come down. So we're using all those tools together. And the nice thing is that almost everybody is doing that now. So if I have an athlete that goes to a different school and gets injured there, at least I know they're using some level of either a VOMS or maybe they're using a SCAT-6 or something that's similar. So we can pull that data back and make sure the athlete's safe. And it's great that, you know, it does start from the top down, but it seemed like the neurocognitive stuff was kind of voodoo, I think, at the beginning. And that was the hard thing for some of the professional teams to adapt or adopt, I should say.
But I think that this is a great example about the field of sports medicine in general and the innumerable contributions it's made to the field of medicine in general. Because, you know, I remember in the NFL when the league, you know, they're going to take a stand, right? And we're going to, you know, really show the public that we're serious about concussions. So we're going to mandate having a neurologist or a neurosurgeon on the field to take care of the concussions. And you know as well as I know, I've got incredible colleagues in neurology, neurosurgery. They're used to head injuries from motor vehicle accidents, from, you know, bleeds, from certain traumas. But nobody knows more, I think, about how to take care of the athletic concussion than the sports medicine specialist and the athletic trainers. Because we know that athlete. We know that after we've done all the Sway medical testing and all the impact testing and all the SCAT testing and all these other return to sport tests, at the end of the day, you know that athlete and you know when the quote unquote, they're a little bit off. There's certain things you can't quantify when you're looking at concussions. Mm-hmm. And I always said like the worst thing that happened, because I would just have these guys looking to me and say, I don't know, what do you think? You think he can play? You think he can not play? You know, concussions are never going to be algorithmic. And it's got to be, rather than just having a neurosurgeon or neurologist, it's got to be that whole sports medicine team that gets together and say, hey, where does this athlete stand? If there's any question, we'll hold them out. We've made a lot of great progress, but I still think there's a far long way to go.
Yeah. And, you know, I had a great conversation with Mickey Collins back when I think you'd had me talk at the NFL conference in Boston on concussion. And him and I were chatting. We were waiting for the panel discussion. He said, "Hey, Andrew, what are you doing for return to play with athletes? How are you? When are you starting it?" And I said, well, we're using impact testing, right? Which he was one of the developers, being a neuropsychologist. And I said, well, if they still have a you know, maybe a one or two on the headache scale, and they might have a few other symptoms, not dizziness, I'd take dizziness out, but I'll get them on the stationary bike and have them start biking to get their heart rate up to see if starving their brain a little bit from the nutrients by exercising, if that brings back symptoms. Yeah. And he goes, that's what we need to do. He's like, nobody's doing that. So they started to pivot, and they were doing that already at UPMC. So it was interesting to see that. I'm like, yeah, you know what? The worst that's going to happen, this athlete's on a stationary bike biking at 85 to 95 RPMs for 10 minutes, maybe on a level 6, not very hard exercise. If their symptoms elevate, they're going to stop biking. If they don't, they're going to bike and they're going to get better. So they're going to start to train. So we started doing that, and it actually helped out a lot, because athletes feel like when they are doing something that is specific to sports-related activity, they know they're getting better. Absolutely. They know they're getting better. They don't go down that rabbit hole of depression and anxiety that we tend to see, especially when we're in the communities that we're in, where academics is key and it's paramount to everything else. They need to get into the MITs, the Harvards, the Boston Colleges, the Vanderbilts. They know that they need what's above their shoulders to be able to function. So we're dealing with concussion. When we can start to evolve them back into, or involve them back into the athletic, whatever their athletic sport is, then they feel better. And then everything starts to get better. So we're seeing really good results with that, which is nice.
But that's, you know, that's the key. Rehab in general, whether you're rehabbing from a concussion or rehabbing from an ACL or rehabbing from a groin injury. You know, if you look at some of the data in the, from the NHL about, you know, who has re-injuries to their hip or groin after the initial injuries, and, you know, what are the risk factors for it? It all comes down to lack, higher risk of re-injury with lack of sport-specific training. So mm-hmm. whether you're, again, you're trying to get back from a concussion, exactly what you just said, you can't just sit there. You're going to have a week of rest, and then you're going to get back and put on the pads and go hit somebody on the football field, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't work that way for on many levels. And it's the same thing with recovering from a groin injury. If you sit there on a leg press machine or hip abduction machine, but you never get on a slide board, you never get on, you never try to simulate the motions of hockey. You know, if you're not recreating the stress that you're going to see in your sport, then you're going to have an enormous chance not only of re-injury, but the performance is going to be well below, because the athlete or the patient's going to be fearful of getting re-injured. So yeah. It's, again, no matter what you're rehabbing, what part of the body, sports-specific training and incrementally bringing athletes along, giving them the confidence is the key, in my opinion.
Now, shift gears a little bit. I think talking about the elite athlete, we talked about the high school athlete quite a bit. What was your, you know, experience working with the pro athlete, and maybe some of the hurdles you, you know, had to try to overcome being, you know, the orthopedic surgeon for, or the team physician for the Red Sox, the Bruins, and the Patriots?
You know, I think that one of the things I learned was that there's an enormous difference between football players, hockey players, and baseball players.
That's right.
And some of that is personal, because it's, you know, you grow up in that culture. I think all of us, when we went to high school, maybe there was a stereotype of your average football player. There was a stereotype of, you know, the women's soccer player or the men's basketball player. But part of that is, you know, you're around a lot of people like yourself, you develop a certain persona. I think a lot of it also that I didn't, you know, understand as much at the time was a lot of it has to do with contracts, because in the NFL, nothing was guaranteed, right? The only thing that's guaranteed is a signing bonus. You can give someone a $100 million contract, but if they get hurt or they get cut, you can cut them tomorrow, and the only thing you owe them is their, whatever their signing bonus was.
Yeah.
Baseball was exactly the opposite. Everything was guaranteed. So, you know, there's a couple of classic cases that were well documented in the press from, you know, when I was there, about people with hamstring tears or oblique injuries who are, you know, sitting out for 4 months, and you're kind of scratching your head saying, what's going on? But, you know, where's their incentive to get back? You know, the exact same injury in baseball took four times as long as hockey or as in football. And I think one of the reasons is, you know, that football player, they realize that their sports medicine staff, the athletic trainer, the physical therapist, the orthopedic surgeon, they need you. Like you are what stands between them and having to get a real job, but from being cut, because they're going to get hurt. It's a traumatic sport. They need your help to get better. So it's a very different, it's a relationship based first on need and hopefully also because of the interpersonal, connections, but they really need you. In baseball, it was very different. It's like, I was a kid likened it to, it's like a parent that can't discipline their child, right? Mm-hmm. You can tell them what to do, but if they didn't like what you had to say, well, first of all, I got 6 more years left on my contract. So sure, go ahead and tell the general manager. He's not going to, what's he going to do? Nothing. Yeah. And I'll just tell my agent, he'll fly me across the country to go see, Dr. So-and-so, and then he'll end up getting to do whatever I want.
Yeah.
So what we learned as a healthcare, what I learned was I was used to being able to say, here's your problem. This is what you need to do, working with the athletic training staff, and then the athlete would do it. And what I had, you almost had it, literally, it's like taking care of kids in baseball. You have to have the buy-in. You have to, establish some trust, establish some rapport, convince them half the time that it was their idea, what they're going to do. But they really just need to see that you're there. You got their best interests at heart, and you're just trying to help take care of them, keep them on the field, and help them perform at the highest level possible. Yeah. And I'll tell you, until you actually operate on, one of the players in the clubhouse, or until you operate on that specific guy, like Curt Schilling was a classic example of someone that, we would butt heads like nothing else because for a variety of reasons, I had huge respect for him as an athlete, but he was a tough guy to take care of at the time for some reasons. But he came up to me at the end and said, "Hey doc, I just want you to know I gave you a hard time. I guarantee you, I played for 2 more years in this league because of what you did for me. And I just want to say thank you." And that meant a lot to me at the time because, when you're in the heat of it, maybe, there was some pushback. But at the end of the day, you have to do the right thing. It doesn't matter if they're a professional athlete, if they're a plumber, if they're an electrician, whatever they are, you have to help them. You have to take their job into account. You have to take their families into account. And I always try to put myself in there. So what would I do for myself in the same situation? But I'll tell you the different sport. Then there's hockey at the far end. I remember taking care of one of the Carolina Hurricanes players during the second period of a game. And this was right after a famous baseball player for the Red Sox was in the paper complaining about his, muscle pull and how he needs another 4 months off. This guy dislocates his elbow.
Yeah.
I get called. I run into the locker room. I got my foot on his chest. I'm pulling as hard as I can. I'm trying to get it in. And I said, "It's almost there. It's almost there." And all of a sudden he rips his arm away from me, grabs his helmet and tries to run on the other. I said, "What are you doing?" He goes, "Well, it's time for my shift. I got to get back up on the ice." I'm like,
"It's like amazing.
Your elbow is dislocated. You cannot play hockey right now." He goes, "No, I can't let my team down." Like, it's a very different mentality in hockey than baseball, than football.
I remember hearing a story about Ray Bourque. He took a slap shot off the face and lost 3 or 4 teeth. I don't know if you were on during that time, but they said, "Ray, you have to go see the oral surgeon." It was like the second period. "We have to go to the ED." Like, "No, just stitch me, get me ready." And he went back out in the third period. It's like missing half his teeth. And that's just the way hockey players are. I remember, I worked with the Bruins for about a month in between. I think this was back in 07 when I think the team was – Red Sox were going down to spring training. So Scott was going to spring training. Donnie was going to the Olympics with the hockey team. It was like a month or so. And I ended up – they needed help up at Wilmington just to work with some of the guys that were injured. So Scott's like, "Hey, can you help out?" Like, "No problem. I'll go up." I remember getting – he's like, "You have to be there at 7 because Leachy's going to be there at 7. And then a couple of the guys are coming in. Like the Toivonen was coming in. A couple of the guys that were hurt. I pull up and it's right before 7 and Leach is standing there with 2 cups of coffee waiting for me to open the door. I'm like, "What's going on?" He's like, "Andrew, where you been? I've been here for like 15 minutes. So like the dedication, this guy is also at the end of his career because he came from the Rangers, I think, and he's the Bruins. But to see that, and I've said that about hockey players, my whole sports medicine career, my athletic training career, they will do everything to stay on the ice and they appreciate every single, and not that athletes don't appreciate it, but I think hockey players are at a different level, which is pretty amazing.
They really do. And they're so down to earth. They're the types of guys that can live right next door to you and you have no idea they're a professional athlete. They're just so humble. Down, they just love their sport.
Yep.
You know, then you got the character of some of the football. I remember when Randy Moss was on the team and, you know, Wednesday I go down for injury checks midweek to try to, you know, tell coach, you know, who I thought was going to be able to play this weekend, who couldn't play. You know, driving from Mass General to Foxborough at 4 o'clock in the afternoon had to be the least predictable drive on the planet. It was either right. going to take Terrible. A half hour or an hour and a half. And it was usually more on the hour and a half side. And, you know, I'm trying to get out of the OR, trying to get down there. And these guys can't go home until they've been checked out, you know, by me. Yeah. And I just remember every time I'd walk in, there's Randy Moss sitting up on the training table and he'd be looking at his watch. And I'd walk, he's like, well, well, well. Look what the mother cat dragged in. Are you sure you're ready for us now? I mean, it's incessant. You never had to worry about having a big ego when you're around some of these guys. They will make sure it stays low.
He was like, straight cash, homie.
Oh, straight cash. Come on, let's go. Time is money.
I'm telling you, I've had some good experiences, I think, in my career. And I think, you know, dealing with some of the pro athletes that I've seen too have been pretty amazing just to deal with. The ones that really do appreciate it are very good. And you're always going to get those ones that don't. But
I'll tell you, one of the best of all, you know, people always ask, you know, who did you enjoy working with the most? And or who did, you know, who tried you the most? And there's too many to mention, too many incredibly quality people and things. But there's a couple that stood out. You know, Ray Bourque, who you mentioned, I can't think of a better leader. I think I can't of a guy that donated or give more to his sport. For my first year with the team, you know, I was, you know, a nobody, and he didn't have to give me any of the kind of respect that he did. But he was just the way he got the players to rally around him. And he truly cared about his teammates, the people that took care of him. He was just an incredible role model. You know, he was amazing. And then, you know, guys like David Ortiz on a different level were just one of the more enjoyable guys to work with. In addition to an immense talent, just one of the funniest human beings kind of you ever want to meet. But also very appreciative of the care you gave. But his ability, you know, people say there's no such thing as clutch in sports. Yeah, you know, the sabermetrics, no such thing as clutch. I challenge you to explain David Ortiz if there's no such thing as clutch. I mean, that guy was Mr. Clutch. But the one person I always come back to that not as many people know about is, you know, if you follow women's soccer, was Christine Lilly.
Yeah.
Christine Lilly, in my mind, is one of the most consummate athletes, leaders, ambassador of her sport of anyone I ever worked with. You know, you see a men's soccer game, international game, and someone slides on the field and he's rolling around like he got shot and needs to go to the ICU until someone sprays water on him, you know, and then he gets off the field. Christine, whether it was her back, her knee, no matter what it was, never complained, always got out there, always wanted to contribute to her teammates, was humble yet confident, truly an amazing athlete and a real pleasure to get to know.
Yeah, that's great. What if you look back at residency and fellowship, what was like your most memorable learning experience that helped shape you as the orthopedist that you are today?
You know, it's funny. I think that's a great question. It's not something I've thought of too much, but there's a couple of things. One is, you know, like we say in surgery, people say, what was your most memorable surgery? I can promise you it wasn't the hopefully 98%+ of cases which go great in the home runs and the Rodney Harrison dislocated knees that, you know, the guy gets back and plays in a Super Bowl afterwards and, you know, all these types of things that you feel so great. Those aren't the ones you remember. It's always the ones that didn't quite go, you know, the way you wanted to. And it's the same way with teachers. You know, I had a chairman named Henry Mankin, who was a giant in the field of orthopedic surgery. But boy, our morning conferences, he could make you feel like you were about this tall. Okay. And he ingrained in it's, you know, I'm reading an x-ray. I'm like, well, I'm not too impressed with what I see here. And he would just cut you off and go, oh, we're so sorry, Dr. Gill, that you're not impressed, that we're not here to impress you. We're not going on. But he was just kind of going on in my choice of words. Yeah. And he would just beat you down. And at the time you kind of like, why is he doing this? But to this day, there's not a time that I read an x-ray that I don't think about it the way he taught me to, or that I don't carefully try to be as exact as I can. And, you know, Reinhold Gans was probably the father of modern day sports medicine, hip surgery. He was a joint replacement reconstructive surgeon, but really started the whole field of femoral acetabular impingement and everything else. And I was worked with him as a fellow, and he would do some things and some techniques that were totally different than anything I had seen in Boston. And I kind of, you know, again, the thing about not too many great ideas come into Boston, but lots get out. Mm-hmm. I kept kind of saying to myself, like, why would you do it like this? Like, who am I? Like, no, I knew nothing, but yet I came from Boston, so I must know all these things. And he just looked at me and said, Tom, how do you know that what I'm doing wrong is wrong and what you think is right? And I said, well, that's what, you know, Dr. Burke told me when I was back in my training. He just shook his head. He said, never accept what someone else says as right or wrong or gospel. You need to go back to the original data sources. You need to go back to the original articles. You need to study the anatomy, the biomechanics, and then it needs to make sense. You need to put the pieces together and then make your decision on what is right and what is wrong. And that, and then the other piece that he used to say was, he would have people that were late 20s, early 30s, mid 30s, who are basically still glorified residents working with him, and they were just holding hooks for him, right? And he wasn't letting them operate and trying to teach them to operate. He would operate and they were watching. And I remember driving with him with a guy named Christian Gerber, who's a very famous shoulder surgeon in Europe. And we were driving from Bern to Zurich. And I said, you know, Professor Guns, do you mind if I ask you, because, you know, in the United States, we help teach our residents how to operate and things. Said, you know, why don't you let so-and-so operate? Why are they always just watching you? And the two of them looked at each other and kind of laughed. And he said something that to this day, I've remembered. He said, Tom, the distance from the head to the hand is much shorter than the distance from the hand to the head. And what he meant by that is, when you study a problem, when you think about a problem, when you look at the surgery, you see what can go right, what goes wrong, you don't need to do 100 of them technically to know how to do it. You can do a couple of them and your learning curve is drastically lowered. The amount of mistakes you're going to make are drastically lowered. Then if I let you alone in an operating room to do about 100 of these cases by yourself, you're going to make all your own mistakes. Those poor patients are going to have all those mistakes made, and you're still only going to be so good. It's like me and my golf game. You know, I don't take any classes. I just go out there and try to hit balls and think I'm going to get better. It doesn't work that way. I need to actually study the game more.
Yeah.
But I remember that to this day. And I think those are some of the real defining moments in my education.
That's great. Now, how does that translate to like mentorship for you? Do you still have like mentors that you go to, or ones that you look back to that help as well? I mean, if you think of the amount of years that you've practiced, do you still think there's a place for mentorship as you continue to practice through your career?
Oh, 100%. You know, I'm still the co-director for the New England Baptist Sports Medicine Fellowship. I still work with all the Tufts orthopedic residents. I still work with the Harvard orthopedic residents that rotate through with me every week. And to me, that's the joy of what I do. You know, it's a little bit cliche to say I learn as much from my students as they do from me, but it's actually true. Like when they ask you a question, you know, hey, Andrew, why is it that you're doing this intervention, this rehab technique? Why are you doing it this way rather than that way? If you don't know it's really tough to kind of make it up if you don't know what you're talking about. So it forces you to stay current with the literature. It forces you to stay current with new techniques. It forces you to try to think of new ways to do things. And, you know, at the end of the day, to help shape, you know, as we talked about in the beginning of this discussion, when you can shape someone's career and their life and help them learn maybe from some of the mistakes that you made so that they don't make the same mistakes. And more importantly, you know, I try to help put them on committees for the American Orthopedic Society for Sports Medicine. You try to help get them in their local chapters and their local organizations, get them involved in research, help them pick the fields that they want to go to. You know, mentorship is critical. And I think one of the sad things right now is if you look at, again, tying in some of the other themes of what we talked about, you know, the financial crises, you look across Boston, you know, Tufts just had about $150 million bailout from the state. You know, MGB, Mass General Brigham lost, you know, $1 billion one quarter, you know, last year or something. It's the financial pressures are so high that carving out time for academic surgeons, physicians, for teaching and just for mentorship and just for research, it's almost unheard of now. It's something that has to happen on the fly. And unless you have a teacher or a mentor who's truly committed to education and can actually do that while you're also taking care of patients, I really fear that the education is going to take a major hit. because mentorship goes so much more than, you know, what's an ACL, what's a rotator cuff, how do you rehab this, how do you operate on that? It really is about, you know, I don't know what I want to go into, or I'm work-life balance is really getting tough right now because I'm working all the time and it's stressing my marriage, my home, and my kids, and I don't know how to balance all this together. You know, how did you do it? What worked? What didn't work? Do you have any advice? Like, that's what we need to be as mentors. And to me, that's probably the most valuable part of what I've done. And until I retire, that'll be what I continue to do. You know, there's not a day that goes by that one of my former fellows or residents doesn't text me a picture of an MRI or text me a copy of an operative note and say, hey, what do you think about this? What should I do here? What did you think about that? Or, hey, I did this like you showed me. Isn't this great? You know, that type of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what really kind of lifts you up and keeps you motivated to keep coming to work every day.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about it often, and we struggle too, even in the PT space where I have, you know, six staff that work with me. I say not under me, but with me every day. Yeah. And we have rounds once a week, and we talk about patient care, and it's on the fly a lot of times. Like, I'd love to carve out 10 hours of my week just to sit next to them and listen and do help them be able to care for patients differently, or if they have questions during the middle of an evaluation or with a care plan for a patient, we can do that. And with clinical students that I get, we try to do our best. And again, it's on the fly. They're asking questions. I had my clinical student the other day ask me, hey, you know what? I had a practical on the shoulder and this is the case that I end up getting. And this is what I said it was. What do you think? He didn't tell me what he thought. He said, well, what do you think it could be? Like, I did this and this, and it didn't seem like it was a labral tear. And I thought it might be, you know, biceps tendonitis. And I thought about it for a second. And I said, no, it sounds like you did exactly what you're supposed to do. Did you do an O'Brien test? Yeah, I did. When it was negative. And he said, I did a Hawkins. It was negative. I said, you're probably where you need to be. So I think that being able to talk to them and get the information out of them the best you can. But I think the evolving education piece, it's that we owe to the people that we work with and the new people that are coming out into the field. If they don't have that mentorship, it's almost like that's when they're going for a new job or interviewing for a job, that's the one of the things they want to know about. Like, what does mentorship look like for them?
But that's actually for those people who might be listening that are looking for jobs, that's an incredibly important thing to look for. What are the opportunities for mentorship? Exactly as you said. I have a choice between 2, 3, 5 jobs right now. Like, the workforce is so stretched thin right now that there's a lot of opportunities. Go for the one where there's room for growth, where there is mentorship.
Yeah.
You can constantly be learning something else. You know, when I'm at the operating room, still the surgery centers of the hospital, I still wander into my colleagues' ORs, see how they're doing it, have a discussion about how and why they're doing it. What little pearls can I take away when I'm at a meeting? And how can I keep getting better? You know, and that's the beauty of a job. And if you have mentorship, it is a lifelong learning process.
And I tell them, like, go look for a mentor. Don't wait for the mentor, because sometimes you might get into a space and it might be, yeah, you know what, I'll help mentor you. But maybe, you know, Christine might be a better mentor for you because you guys are closer in practice. Maybe that's something that you might have a better experience with. But always reach out to somebody else. And it could be multiple people. It could be an old professor. It doesn't have to be someone within your practice. So we do talk about it quite often. I think it helps people a lot. Kind of to close out, there's one thing I wanted to ask you, and it'd be interesting to see what your answer is. But if you met your 25-year-old self today,
ask me that.
What would you tell yourself? I mean, what advice would you give yourself coming in as a medical student, you know, thinking, hey, I'm going to be, what would you tell yourself, what you know now, what you've experienced over your career? What is the maybe one piece of advice you'd give yourself?
That's a great question. There's not one, there's probably 50, which hopefully means I've been doing some reflecting, you know, over the years. I think the biggest thing I tell myself is, don't think you have all the answers right now. When I was 25, I thought, boom, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to go to college, med school, residency, fellowship. I'm going to become a team doctor. I'm going to do this, boom, boom, boom. And you get these blinders on.
Yeah.
And I think a couple of different things happen. One is you get so tunnel visioned that you kind of don't smell the roses as much along the way, right? You got to take time to look around, have a little bit of, you know, work-life balance. I always tell people work-life balance is kind of a oxymoron for the first 5 years of your career. You kind of just need to work hard and get things done. But you do have to remember with family, friends, you know, make sure you're taking care of yourself along the way. But I think to answer your question, I think first is don't become so tunnel visioned that you don't stay open-minded to opportunities that maybe you hadn't thought about when they present themselves. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I want to, you know, work, you know, at MGH in Boston and kind of stay here close to town. But you know what? If there's a great opportunity that arises in Chicago and it's to do exactly what I want and I can even do more teaching, be open to that or, you know, whatever it is. So it's don't have preconceived notions. Be willing to pivot when great opportunities arise. And the last thing is that, you know, things are never as bad as they seem and they're never as good as they seem. Mm-hmm. None of us is invincible. And I think that stay humble, work hard and do it with the people you care about and you'll have a great career.
That was an excellent answer. I couldn't have said it better myself. Well, thank you. I do appreciate your time. I know you're busy, especially on a weekend. I hope there's many more years of us working together. I truly, truly cherish our relationship and what you bring to my learning experience, and the people that we refer over to you, they have a great experience. So, again, thank you very much. And, we'll have to catch up again soon. May have another session or maybe branch us off into some type of series that we can continue to look back onto.
I'd love it. And by the way, the feeling is absolutely mutual. I look at my colleagues and my partners over the years and, you know, there's two or three people that for me, my career wouldn't be what it is, and my personal enjoyment of my career wouldn't be what it is without them. And you are one of those people. The other thing I was just going to say is I'm looking over your shoulder on this podcast, and given the double black diamond slope, I see we are going to be together for years to come, whether it's professionally or you're going to show up as a patient pretty soon with those double blacks. So, Dick Stedman used to say, it's not a question of if, it's when it comes to skiing and knee injuries. So, on that, I'm going to say, have a great
thank
one.
You. Thank you. I truly appreciate it.
Take care.
Thanks, Dr. Gill.
Bye.
Thank you for tuning in to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. This is your creator and host, Andrew Rizza. If you enjoyed the content from today's episode, give us a like, leave a comment, and share on social media. You can find us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow us on Instagram at Behind Sports Med Podcast, on X under AJR Sports Sci, or check out our websites at ajrsportscience.podbean.com and at ajrsportscience.com. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel at AJR Sports Science. Stay tuned for our next episode.